Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 57, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. A Detroit judge rules that access to literacy is not a constitutional right. Louisiana reverses a policy that was holding back thousands of students, and we have an update on the Teach Grant debacle. Stay with us. Class Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week, we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education. Plus, we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, just how much does exercise affect the brain when learning? Hello, everybody. Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how are you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, you guys are knee-deep in accountability season, aren't you?
We certainly are. And if you've never had the pleasure of having 17 phone calls on the 4th of July from various administrators that are your customers, then you have not lived. That's what I say.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, and for anyone that doesn't realize what they're calling about, I guess they're finding out like how they did from the previous year, and you guys have the magic formula to tell them, right?
That's correct. Well, they're finding out, basically they're getting their state test scores that have just been finally released. And of course, the state model, the state accountability model, which assigns A through F ratings for schools and districts, uses those state test scores. And so we basically have used the business rules that the state uses that are public information, and we're able to run that those business rules against their data and determine a good guess. We call it a sneak peek about how well they're going to do. So we have like out of the 10 or 11 components for a high school, we have probably seven of them, eight of them right now. So there's still some unknowns that they'll fill in the blanks a little bit as it gets later in the season. But we're just giving them kind of a heads up that, you know, here's how your kids did and here's how they might compare from last year.
I got a message from my new principal, even though I'm not, you know, I wasn't part of their previous
testing. Oh, basically saying
year,
how the school did?
But I'm part of the Remind going forward. And so he was super excited. I think he had gotten some information from School Status, and I guess he was letting the teachers know to check an email that they had some exciting.
Yeah, if you could only stop using Remind, we'd be in great shape. So, but no, we don't have it set up for staff yet, but that's coming too. So,
well, I'm sure once you do, then
I won't shame him too badly. I don't think so.
Right. Well, good stuff. Lissa, why don't we jump into the teacher's lounge before Russ gets you in trouble with your new boss?
Or if my new boss gets in trouble with Russ.
Right,
they write the check, not the other way around.
Well, this is a story out of the New York Times from talking about schools in Detroit, Michigan. A federal court district judge just ruled that students do not have a right basically to a better education.
A constitutional right.
He's saying, they called it different ways. They said a right, a constitutional right for access to literacy or for, you know, a minimally adequate education. But basically, there was a lawsuit brought forward saying, you know what, these schools in Detroit are, and I saw photos.
They're bad.
Yeah. There's rats running around. The ceiling's fallen in. They have no heat for the winter, so they're freezing cold in the winter. I mean, just the textbooks are, you know, from the 90s and molded. There's not even teachers in some of the classrooms. Like, so, you know, basically they came forth with a lawsuit saying, you know, this is kind of, you know, this is racially discriminant because, you know, we live in these lower socioeconomic areas that feed the school, and there's been mismanagement of funds, and our children are paying the price for it, and this would never be allowed in other neighborhoods. And so basically it went all the way to Judge Stephen Murphy III in the federal court district, and he basically said that the lawsuit failed to show racial discrimination in the Detroit schools.
So I guess that raises the question, and I want you to chime in on this, Russ. Should it be a constitutional right? Should literacy and a right to being taught how to read and learn be a constitutional right, or is it just something that we should do and it not be a constitutional right?
Yeah, I'm really interested in as to why this is a federal, why this was brought in federal court. Because while there may not be a state or a federal right to education or right to what's the word there? Literacy, I guess. Mm-hmm. That's the big ruling was around literacy. Like, that's right. Then most state constitutions, I was just in fact pulling up some of our surrounding states. So most states, though, have a right to a free public education that or an adequate education mm-hmm. written into their constitution. So it's interesting because federal unless it contradicts, unless state law and federal law contradict each other in some way, then generally federal courts do not opine as to whether somebody's meeting their state constitutional obligations. However, there was the genesis of all this was the state of Arkansas many years ago. They actually had an education equity lawsuit that essentially they looked at the way that states divided funding, and they determined that areas that had less of a smaller tax base rather of assessed valuation or ever how they do it in Arkansas, because those areas were generally more socioeconomic depressed, then those kids were not getting the same adequate education. And so the state was forced to enter into a consent decree in which education was funded according to a more equitable funding formula. And as I understand it, it was or may currently be the first item out the gate. So whenever they start funding state priorities through the legislative process, I believe that K-12 has to be one of the first things that they fund under a consent decree with the federal government. So it's interesting. I understand the equity angle. And I think that they probably have a legitimate case. I've not read enough about it to know, though, why they actually brought it forth.
It seemed like they were testing the waters. I think when you look
right,
at the last...
Right, they were trying to say that it was a civil rights issue, that they were mismanaging funds, which I bet they were, saying that more money was sent elsewhere to higher performing white schools mm-hmm. and less money was being sent to these schools. Then the children that have no choice but to go to these schools because that's where they live are, that it's just an outcry of this is and the judge did state that
this is ridiculous.
This is shocking the way these schools look yeah. and it, but that they didn't make a big enough case. Almost like he was saying, go back and get some more stuff.
And so the reason this article caught my attention is just because, it's in the New York Times, but it was everywhere, all mm-hmm. sorts of publications. And that headline that, literacy is not a constitutional right. This is ridiculous. That's our natural reaction. But when you really kind of dive deep into it, I mean, even the expert in the New York Times, who's an expert in education and constitutional law, is like, this would have had a better chance at the state level. And he said, quote, in theory, it'd be a great breakthrough to have the federal courts recognize education as a fundamental right, he said, but I see no chance of that happening in my lifetime.
Right.
So
this is just so tough, though, and, if you're just going down to the local level, because the tax dollars, they go to that school where you live, and so if you're in these areas where they're maybe fleeing, then of course the schools are going to become a little more dilapidated also, which is not fair for the people that live there and are trying to make a life there and sending their children to that neighborhood school, and it's just getting worse and worse and worse. And at some point, isn't there a bailout or something?
Well,
am I just a bleeding heart?
Well, and think about this. I'll propose this to you. I mean, amendments we know are very difficult to pass, but is it that far-fetched to think that maybe the federal government should pass an amendment saying that it is a constitutional right to have, some sort of form of adequate education?
I think that it would be difficult I think it's a state's rights issue. I mean, I guess they could add it for sure. But yeah, you kind of have to say, like, if it's a state's rights issue, I don't believe a state truly has the right to deprive a child of a free and adequate public education.
But they're saying that they're not depriving. They're saying no, school's open, and we're not depriving you of an education. Yeah. You can
it just felt like
not up to par. you know.
This feels like more of a jurisdictional complaint than anything for me. Like, it feels like the judge wanted to do something, but, you know, because if, you know, they have, judges are subject to review like everybody else. So, you know, they have an appellate court above them and a Supreme Court ultimately. And especially the way the Supreme Court's voting these days, it's very unlikely that if it ever went to the Supreme Court that it would be upheld.
Right.
Simply because it's such a big states' rights Supreme Court right now.
But it did totally turn all eyes onto the city schools.
That's great. Maybe they
hopefully they'll have some change.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Well, speaking of state and education, Russ, I think you've got a pretty interesting one out of Louisiana, right?
Yeah, absolutely do. So a lot of states have moved towards over the past few years. There's a big agenda that's been pushed by the school reform movement, but largely it's been pressed by the American Legislative Exchange Council and a few other conservative groups. One of the things they're talking about is eliminating social promotion so that if a student doesn't pass a benchmark, then they basically don't get to go to the next grade, right? And if they miss, and then a lot of them have built-in provisions that actually still allow social promotion. After a year or two, like if they're just not going to get it, then let's keep moving them on, which seems kind of counterintuitive. But a state that's had this for some time is Louisiana. And what percentage of students do you folks think have been withheld at least one grade level in public schools in Louisiana?
Because of reading, I guess, like not reading benchmarks?
I think because of any reason. So okay. What percentage of students do you think have had to repeat at least one grade?
50. Five.
Wow, we're way off of each other.
you are way off. It's about 30%. And in New Orleans,
I didn't win in the Price is Right.
In Orleans Parish, it's actually a little higher. It's 40%. So that's almost half of the students. I mean, I know it's not half, but it's almost half of the students, 40% that have been held back at least once. And we work at statistics, and I can just tell you that students who are withheld more than one grade level or at least one grade level, they tend to drop out when they get in the eighth grade. And so this is a real problem. And so this, several folks have started looking into this, and their statewide assessment is the Louisiana Educational Assessment Program, LEAP. And it's a fourth grade gate. Mississippi has a third grade gate. A lot of other states have third grade gates as well. And because the math on reading on grade level for third grade is also very important. I think it's well-intentioned, but 17 states have these laws that say that, hey, if you don't pass this assessment, then you will not be promoted socially. And so effectively, now the state has started backing off of that. So they're actually repealing and ending that policy. So because what it turns out is that it wasn't all that effective at getting kids to where they wanted to be, right? So it you know, you could tell them that they have to repeat the test and that they have to have remediation, but holding them back actually didn't lead to better outcomes for students in the end. And so the Louisiana State Legislature decided to end it, which I think is great because what happens at these, it bottlenecks, right? So if you have kids that, you know, can't move on to the fourth grade, or in this case, can't move on to the fifth grade because they didn't pass the test in the fourth grade, those kids don't disappear, right? Let's say that you have a third of them, then you're going to have to build our third classrooms or take teachers from the fourth grade and move to the third grade or fifth grade to fourth grade, depending on your state. And it just really doesn't solve a lot of problem. Now, it could be that it highlights the issue and that it shows the severity of the issue, but holding back the student really doesn't lead to better outcomes in the end for these students, which isn't surprising, I think, to almost anybody.
So what does lead to better outcomes then? I mean, what do? You just, you pass them on when they can't read? Like, how's that?
No, I think what leads to better outcomes is tutoring. Actually getting involved on a one-to-one level with those students and trying to get them before they get to the third grade gate. So instead of it being this kind of sieve that blocks people from going through, you start identifying these problems like a pre-K screener, for instance, which a lot of states do now. And so if you can spot, if you look at the concept, there's a concept called neuroplasticity that deals with, and I don't want to start making people not off here, but neuroplasticity deals with the ability for the brain to change over time. And if you look at a child's brain, it's like concrete. And whenever it's new, it's wet, and you could pour it in just about any shape you want it to. It's very resilient. And there are things that you can do to get it on track if it falls off track. But as kids tend to age, that concrete hardens over time, and it becomes harder for them to learn and change. And by the time they're 10 or 11, a large part of their personality and their cognitive processes are already set. And so So you have to catch these things as early as possible, because really you're trying to catch the horse that's already out of the barn by the time you get to the third grade. It is an important benchmark year, but by saying it's a third grade gate, it negates everything that happens in the second, first grade, kindergarten, and pre-K, which is also one of the number one things a state can do to increase outcomes for students, is to have a state mandated and a state provided pre-K program so that kids start learning to read and they start learning their letters and things like that before they have to, you know, pass this third grade gate test.
It brings to mind some of our previous episodes, like even when you were talking about teacher evaluations, how, you know, ineffective it is to just give the teacher a score. If you feel like the teacher's not doing something that, you know, is getting in the way of job performance, the best way to have growth is to say, here's what we're seeing, here's how we can bridge this gap, here's some things you can do, and then you'll see improvement. So you need to do the same thing with the students. You know, I remember another episode where a teacher said that that's what they do at the end of the year, is they kind of sum up and have a little mini conference with each student to just say, look, here's some problem areas, here's some things that are going to show their ugly head the next year. You need to know that about yourself
point
and
is,
work at it.
Point is, we've had some really valuable content on this show.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I was going for. Yeah. But I do think it is important to, I know as a teacher, I taught second grade self-contained and I taught fifth grade. So I know that for second grade, I remember, you know, a lot of second grade teachers will say things like, yeah, whew, you know, I wouldn't want to be a third grade teacher, you know, but I remember I used to think, but like, where our names on that too, because they just had us, you know, they were just with us. Sure, so right. Our names on there too. So I think that it's really important for, I know with just friends, parents of mine, you know, that they say, I know my child struggles in reading. I just don't know what to do. Like, it's almost like nobody ever took the time to say to the parent and the child together in the same room, hey, this is a bit of a hump that you've got to get over. It's not impossible. Here's some things you can do. Here's some resources. Here's some things this summer you can do.
That is,
why not do that in kindergarten, first, second grade, at the end of the year? Go ahead. Because, yeah, you're right. Third grade is a door slammed in their face at the end, but they should have seen it coming if they had an invested teacher, you know.
Well,
and
I think a lot of
it's an uncomfortable conversation, but it has to be had.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, Lissa. And on this show, that can be a little rare, I think, sometimes. but I can't agree with you more. I think you want to know the truth is that I think often schools, and this is, look, we have a lot of customers that are schools. So I may say something that's going to piss somebody off. But the honest to goodness truth is a lot of the times that's a legitimate criticism that I don't know what to do, right?
And they shouldn't know what to do.
Didn't go to school for this, right?
Exactly.
But the secret is often a lot of teachers don't know what to tell them, or they're afraid to tell them something for telling them the wrong thing. Uh-huh. And that's the part of the district where the district has to get involved and provide resources in a way that teachers can consume. And there has to be a way to disseminate that on a reoccurring basis with parents. That is parent engagement. Mm-hmm. Okay. Having a PTA meeting is not parent engagement,
right?
Okay? It's just not. Parent engagement is a continual process by which people talk about a student and what's going on with that student. And parents are given actionable things that they can do a little bit every day to help bring that student back on track.
We're way over on time on this topic, but quick question for both you guys, yes or no answer. Are we going to see more states roll back these rules of holding students back?
Probably.
Yeah. Yes. And the reason I think is because I think we're about to see a huge shift against standardized testing.
Yes. And there needs to be a huge
shift. I think you're about to see unilaterally states move to more community-based accountability instead of federal top-down accountability on certain things. And there's, you know, there are folks at the Jeb Bush's Foundation that'll completely disagree with me on this, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing. I think that there's a lot of it. I work in a company that deals in student data, and I could tell you that kids in some districts are assessed too often.
So remember the TEACH grant thing, debacle? We've covered this twice on the show.
A couple times, yes.
Yeah, there's a little bit of movement there. And it has garnered the attention of 19 U.S. senators. So that is somewhat positive, and they have apparently signed a letter and sent it to the Secretary of Education saying, and citing NPR's reporting on this about how, I really should bring people up to speed, this is the TEACH grant where apparently if their paperwork wasn't filled out to the T, they were had their grants turned into loans with interest, and all these teachers basically got...
stuck with the bill.
Yes, thank you. That your word was way more appropriate than what I was about to say.
I felt like you were saying something. I just broke eye contact. Yeah, I was like, I'm not going there with you.
Get the beep button ready.
Stuck with the bill. So anyhow, they basically sent a letter to the secretary saying it is urgent that these mistakes are fixed. Now, whether or not we'll see a fix very urgently, there's another story, but it's good to see some movement.
Well, it is good to see that. And the fact is that the 10 years is coming up on that, right? And so that's a big piece of it. It's like people that are in public service for those grants, you know, they're supposed to work for 10 years and they get like loan forgiveness and things like that. Now we're just starting to see this. And it really does feel like our State Department of Education in Washington is welching on the deal.
What's disappointing is the 19 U.S. senators that signed off on the letter, party lines.
All Democrats, and
it's like, how can you not get bipartisan support? Now, maybe another letter will come with a bunch of Republican signatures, and they'll say the same thing, but just with different signatures. I don't know, but I mean, this seems like something that everyone should be able to get behind. Let's not rip off our teachers.
Exactly.
It seems like not shades of gray here. This seems like those teachers are getting screwed by the federal government, and the money's already there, so why not make it right?
Right. Why does anyone want to be caught holding that ball? I would be like, fix it.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Interesting, Russ, that you were talking about neuroplasticity. We have an interview today for our Bright Idea, and she teaches educators about the brain and how knowing about the brain can affect what we teach our students and how we teach our students. And today, she's talking to us about exercise and the brain, and how important it is to actually move around in the classroom and not just be like a bump on the log. So,
well, cool. Yeah, fantastic. I know a lot of schools are doing this mile a day thing where they get out and run a mile a day, every single person in the school.
That's
teachers,
good.
Teachers, kids, they all go run, jog, walk a mile.
Our guest in today's Bright Idea segment was a high school history and psychology teacher for 14 years before diving into the world of neuroscience. Kim Bevel, who you can find at kimbevel.com, now helps train educators to understand how the brain works so educators can get better results in the classroom. Kim, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Nick. I appreciate it.
Kim, you offer a large menu of professional development courses, but I'd like to start by focusing on a topic that I've always wanted to take a deeper dive into, and that's exercising and the brain and how the two affect each other. I've seen a lot of blurbs about this online, but I really wanted to ask you, how much can exercise really affect the brain and how students react in the classroom?
Well, the topic of movement and the brain is truly not a new one. I mean, we've been moving for centuries, so it's kind of heartbreaking that it's only in the last 10 years that we take a look at exercise as something that was truly fundamental. So when it comes to our students in the classroom, I don't know why we hold the two ideas separate, that exercising in our life is different than exercise as it comes to the classroom. What I found in the last few years is we kind of as a society accept that movement is really important. We all know we have to exercise a certain number of times a week. And hopefully more recently, we've had an epiphany that, no, wait, moving every day is a really good idea. So our students in the classroom is a natural, I suppose, application. It's just that we as well-intentioned educators feel like keeping our students sitting is best practice, when what we now know is, as a result of having a sedentary society, we need to have our students moving more frequently. What I find with people I work with is the greatest holdouts, the most traditional teachers who are so concerned about their content, have finally just had to acquiesce and throw their hands up and say, oh my gosh, it turns out that when I let my students, whether they're 5 years old, whether they're 3 years old, whether they're 53 years old, because I work with college professors, when I let them get up and move, they can think, they focus, they process, they're much more alert and engaged. And quite simply, it is the idea that getting up and moving increases your blood flow, which bathes your prefrontal cortex with your learning chemicals and neurotransmitters that allow us to recall. But even more research is indicating that it's not just recall. It's not just that we can focus and feel more energetic. It's that literally movement is increasing our neural connections in our prefrontal cortex. And number one, most important, I think, side effect for exercise in a learner or someone who doesn't want to get doesn't want to have dementia because they want to keep their cognitive processing skills, is it trains your attention. Now, I have to make sure I explain why that matters so much, is because the act of paying attention to one thing at the expense of all others seems to dictate your learning ability, seems to dictate working memory. And before you overthink which type of memory working memory is, it's the thing you're using right now to listen to you, Nick, to me, and to be able to remember it for a few minutes, to turn to the person next to you and say, that show just said we need to make sure we get our students up and move them. And when I say get them up and move them, I mean they need to be up every 15 to 20 minutes, that no more than 20 minutes of sitting during a lecture, during an explicit session. I'm not talking about a PE class where it's an implicit, they're up and they're moving. Not that PE isn't cognitive, but if in a PE class, the PE teacher is going to be training on the rules of a game or an activity, they only have about a 15-minute window at best, 20 max. Then they have to get up and move them so that that chemistry, so that the blood flow increases. So the more you move, the more your brain is going to be able to pay attention.
So let me stop you there. When you say that, you know, students should be moving every 20 minutes, and say you're talking to a group of teachers, do you get pushback to say, how do we pull that off? That's a lot of movement.
I would probably get that pushback at 16 minutes, but I usually get them up and have them moving. And I will show them, did you see? Did you notice? Did you feel what was happening to your own attention before I had you move? So we'll get up and we'll play either a game, or I'll have them do something related to fitness. Those are two different types of movements. And the idea in the last 5 years is that it's not all moves are created equally. The more complex the moves, the more brain friendly. The more complex.
Oh, really?
Exactly.
So specifically, like, what's a complex movement that you would recommend?
I would recommend, well, one of a number would be, say, juggling. And juggling requires that you are totally focused on your right hand and your left hand and three objects that you're tossing through the air, all while you're maintaining your balance, because it increases your focus and attention to what it is you're doing at expense of all others. So here's the cool thing that came out of Harvard after 2008, and that was the more you focus and pay attention to one thing, the more your frontal cortex grows neurons related to attention, which means before and after juggling, they would use an MRI to measure the amount of gray matter in your frontal cortex. And what they found specifically with the task of juggling was inside of 6 weeks of juggling for 20 minutes, working towards fluent juggling, what they found was on average 3% increase in the gray matter in their frontal cortex in the areas in charge of attention.
I know that you work with educators, you're a former educator, but you also apply this probably to businesses and so forth, do you not?
Yes. As a matter of fact, Google is beginning to institute movement and movement practices. They started some of the work, not with Google, but in Puerto Rico, that their employees were, they were having a scheduled every 20 minute, everybody gets up and does some kind of movement for about 2 to 3 minutes. And what I tell teachers is you have to decide what the effect is you're looking for. Getting up and moving for 2 to 3 minutes may work nicely in the morning, but after 2 or 2:30 in the afternoon, when people are climbing the walls from a big long day of sitting and learning or working and processing, that getting up and moving in the workplace helps them to think and process differently as well. Because it turns out we are all little adorable machines that have to have blood flow, where we're bathed with dopamine, norepinephrine, serotonin, beta endorphins, all of your chemicals allow your executive function to process. So people with attention deficits would have a low level of blood flow in their frontal cortex. So what John Rady at Harvard tells us is, should teachers, should employers get the human body up to move for 2 to 3 minutes, it can help to inflate the blood flow in the frontal cortex, something we use Ritalin or Adderall to do artificially.
You kind of indicated this at the beginning, but I think you acknowledge that, you know, a lot of people now are aware that this makes a difference, but are you seeing it practiced in classrooms?
I see it in select areas. Usually I see it with people who've tried it. So I'll have clients come back and say, you know, when I left here, I kind of rolled my eyes at your idea that I get them up and move them every 20 minutes because my thought was I'll never get them calmed down again. And they come back to me with hat in hand and say, I'm so sorry, I'll never go back. One time I was working in Wyoming and I had a male and a female educator who worked in a boys' correctional facility. And they said, they both remembered kind of giggling as I said, you get them up and move them every 20 minutes and you'll never go back. You'll get more done than you ever imagined with less time. And their attitude is different. Their behavior is different. And you're going to be shocked that you're going to build a relationship with them. It's like they're going to like you now and you don't even have to work on it. And they're going to get along with others. So it was probably 2 months later, these same two educators who worked at the correctional facility came to me and said, we signed up for your training because we felt like we had to come and tell you we owed you an apology. You didn't know you needed. They said, we were wrong. Our very difficult male teenagers, they said the behavior is just completely different. Students participate, they communicate, and they said, if we get them up at 10 minutes, it's even better than 15 minutes, and 15 is even better than 20. They said, we can't believe the difference. The discipline behaviors have all but disappeared, and their engagement and their relationships with it. They said, we just had no idea how many things were going to improve that we didn't even know. And I hear these things on a regular basis. When I get them up and I move them on a regular schedule, my classroom flows so much more smoothly. And like I said, it doesn't matter. I have professors who come back and say, I used to have lethargic, I used to have quiet, I used to have inattentive, and now I have people who just really are there with me. And you can almost feel it in a room at 20 minutes. You can feel the energy sort of begin to subside. And I'm very clear, that's when it's time.
So if I understand you right, it's definitely helping with attention. And I think you touched on this a little bit when you talked about active memory or active, what was the term you used?
Working memory.
Okay, working memory. So it is actually improving your memory as well. It's not just that you're listening better and you're more attentive, like you're actually retaining information better. Is that correct?
So what we have in the last 15 years, and even more in the last 3 or 4 years, is a significant body of evidence that says the higher your working memory, your ability to pay attention right now, like if I were to tell you my phone number, you would use your working memory to say it back to me. The higher your working memory, what cognitive psychologists have found is, the higher your IQ. Mm-hmm. That literally, and you know, IQ, take it for what it's worth, but intelligence. And that people with a higher working memory have anywhere from 50 to 70% increased intelligence. That their creativity, their problem solving, their decision making, their ability to make choices under pressure is going to be improved. And the reason is what we know about memory. You will not remember anything to which you did not pay attention. So what we understand is, what cognitive psychologists and memory experts are telling us is, the better your attention, the higher your working memory. So people who have what they call chronic meditation practice, your monks and so forth, have a significantly thicker prefrontal cortex. The better you pay attention, the more neurons that are attention neurons. That correlates with a higher working memory. So the better you pay attention, the higher your working memory. The better working memory means that's creativity, innovation, that's academic success, that's workplace success. So working memory is like the holy grail of your brain.
If you had a magic wand and you could influence, whether it be the Department of Education at a state level, federal level, legislators, teachers, principals, whoever, what would you tell them? Like, what's the easiest thing that they could do, change tomorrow to make this better?
If every single school, no matter what age we're educating, did 30 minutes of activity every day, 30 minutes of activity every day to get their heart rate up, at least a 70% maximum heart rate, what they're going to see is an increase in math skills and second, an increase in reading and processing. And that would save us a fortune in buying new materials for math, buying new materials for reading. It's going to improve spatial processing. And what we know about spatial reasoning is it correlates with IQ. And that's where STEM is going to come from: science, technology, engineering, and math. And we're told that the United States is falling behind dangerously in all of these areas. And what they're looking for is an explanation. Well, one of the probably most important explanations is we have a sedentary society. We get moving every day, and the side effect is going to be our ability to process increases as if by magic.
If our listeners want to learn more, where's the best place to find you? Are you on Twitter or Instagram, or where do you like to live?
I am certainly going to be on Facebook, and I do have a Twitter account. So if you want to communicate with me, you can communicate with me on Twitter. Or good old-fashioned emailing. You can email me at kim@kimbevel.com.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kim. Here's what I'd like to do. I want to continue our conversation, but I'd like to shift that towards Hollywood and video games and what effects those mediums are having on our kids' brains. But we're going to save that for next week, so be sure to tune back in to listen for that. Thanks, Kim.
Thank you, Nick.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismiss. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortigo, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed.